Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. This is Retention Experts with Bree Ruckus.
Great. Quick introduction here. My background was actually helping to run growth for different companies, both full-time and as a consultant for about 11 years. Actually, I spent more time on the retention side than the acquisition side. So this event is really fun for me. And then I tried to utilize that experience to help some of my clients start recruiting. That veered off into me building an executive recruiting firm. And that's what I do these days. We're a team of nine. We basically recruit everyone's growth teams. And I'm based in Brooklyn.
I'm Katie. I run CRM and e-commerce at Parsley Health. And I also really got my start in retention at Harry's. And yeah, I'm based in Los Angeles right now.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm based in the Bay Area. I started at Vivino in 2014. I started in growth. And then I actually transitioned to a retention side as we tried to monetize our user base there. About a year ago, I grew frustrated with some of our email creation workflows at Vivino. So I spun up my own company, Solero, which I co-founded last August. I've been at that for about a year now.
Hi, I'm Jenna. I am based in New York as well, like some of the other people on the call. I'm actually in our beautiful Equinox office right now. I think I'm one of the only ones in NYC in the office. But I've been at Equinox about a year and a half, leading CRM and member marketing. And before that, been at a number of startups, Casper, Trade Coffee, Tough Mudder. Yeah, so happy to be here.
Hey guys, I'm Joey. Started actually in advertising in New York. I went to school and then moved over to the client side. I've done loyalty marketing at Visa and met Anish over at HP Snapfish and then Lyft, One Medical, and here I'm now at Open Door.
Cool. Let's dive into some questions here. You know, what were some tactics or strategies that have really moved the needle for you? They could be broad or it could be some really specific campaign that you guys ran over the last year or two that were pretty impressive and unique that people could learn from.
I can go. This is Jenna. So at Equinox, when I joined, so this company is 30 years old and has had a huge brand marketing focus, huge acquisition sales focus, but really only started thinking about member marketing seriously over the last few years. So when I joined, we had a new member flow, but it wasn't very dynamic. It was mostly email based. We had some things going on in the app as well, which is imperative to our members. That's how they book their classes. That's how they check into the club. But we weren't doing a ton that was personalized to them, and app and email weren't speaking to each other. And they were basically getting bombarded over the course of their first month with Equinox or even their first week. In their first week, they'd maybe get like 25 communications, combo of app and email, marketing email. And then we have our club teams reaching out to, you know, offer them a comp personal training session, offer them to come in and try a group fitness class. And it's just a lot. And it didn't all speak to each other and it wasn't all relevant. So one of the big projects I tackled here early on was looking at our new member flow and figuring out how can we cut down on it so that they're not getting that many touch points, as well as how can we personalize it so it's about what they care about. So, you know, if we have 100 plus locations, we have a ton of members, all who have different interests, whether it be fitness or personal training or just working out on their own. So we used our data and we used what our members were engaging with to send them comms only about the parts of the business that they showed interest in. And that's really moved the needle in terms of driving engagement and decreasing email and subscribes early on so we can actually keep in touch with these members.
Yeah, I'll add on to that. I think retention tactics is kind of an interesting thought. So in thinking about it, it's like a subscription model, say like Equinox or One Medical, a lot of the stuff I used to do would be signal tracking prior to the end of your kind of session or your subscription. And what that does is it builds a propensity model for who's going to come back. So, you know, you take that segment, you say, all right, we've got you covered. But then you start to look at all the signals or engagements that all the other people have done and say, all right, we need these reminders post subscription to say, hey, this is what you did. This is the value you got out of it. And I think by using that kind of signal modeling from the app and from, because as Jenna mentioned, there's a lot of different channels that are getting at you. But if you're filtering or distilling down those specific things and coming from one point of view and one channel, that person will realize, oh, wow, they understand what I've done and they understand the value that it brought to me. So post subscription in kind of the win back phase, you just remind them. And that's really worked in the past.
Nice. I can speak a little bit to that as well. Some of the most successful programs that I've been lucky enough to either learn more about or work on and grow are basically creating predictors for what someone is going to purchase next. So looking at what someone's, the first product that someone purchased, or as a whole throughout your entire kind of data set, and then looking what their next most likely purchased product will be. So for, you know, for Vivino, it could be if your first purchase was Chardonnay, your next most likely purchase might have been, I don't know, rosé or something like that. And it may have been 42 days later. So, you know, you know, looking at the entire data set, that's someone's next most likely purchase. So let's say if you know that 42 days later, they're likely to have purchased rosé, you know, maybe 35 days after their first purchase, you send them an email saying, hey, we think you might be interested in rosé just based off all the information we have. So here's some offers on rosé. And that's worked really well. They did that a lot at Shutterfly, where we're able to say, oh, hey, everyone who has purchased green, you know, Christmas cards might really like these other green Christmas cards as well, because that's the next most likely thing that they've often purchased. Thumbtack as well, which is a local services product where, you know, we knew for everyone who sort of like, we actually built a brand new program when I was consulting for them, where basically everyone who, you know, let's say you made a request for an event photographer, based off of the data, most of those people, their next most likely request was for an event DJ. And it was, you know, within 24 hours. So we knew, hey, people who do that are throwing a party. Let's get them really quick for an event DJ and all these other event services. And then it just pushed up that program actually ended up working really well. We got an 8x lift versus our control on that one. So yeah, try to figure out what someone's next most likely purchase is.
Yeah, to piggyback off of that, Anish, at Vivino, we had a lot of success coordinating with the merchandising team. It was very much the responsibility of the lifecycle team, CRM team, to identify segments and what their needs were. And Vivino, they have a huge team of wine buyers that are going out and sourcing wines. And we had a ton of success just coordinating and saying like, hey, we've got this segment, let's say Chardonnay buyers, and we know that they want to buy rosé next. Can we get it on the calendar so we can email out that wine and hit this segment and get them buying batch? And then I would actually add a little contrast. I mean, a lot of these answers have been around subscription, but for, you know, your classic e-commerce companies like Vivino, doubling down and finding out who your habitual buyers are and sending them even more emails, hitting them with more touch points, it can be a winning strategy. It can drive a lot of revenue. And then on the flip side, you know, you can scale back a lot of that frequency on people who are not habitual, and just learning and pocketing people in those different buckets can drive a lot of revenue. And it's a very simple tactic, but very effective.
Really loyal customers just realize you're going to get three times as much email as a prize.
Building off of that, talking about customer segmentation, segmenting customers also on their email engagement or engagement of whatever channel. So you know who can like tolerate higher frequency in order to get them to convert and purchase more versus who you should either not use that channel or be more careful about frequency so that you're able to manage both AOB conversion and unsub.
Cool. We can jump into the next one, Grace. When it comes to post-purchase automations, how do you think about frequency versus AOV? And for those of you who don't know, AOV is average order value. If you take the total of the cart that someone's purchasing, that's going to be the AOV.
I think Brent mentioned it earlier or just now about in regards to what type of e-commerce product it is in regards to frequency. So just a basic RFM model, right? Recency, frequency, or reach frequency, and then monetary, right? I think with a lot of low intent, high volume type products, it's always about frequency. And then the AOV goes to more high involvement products like a car, right? You're not going to try to sell them a car every week. So you should understand kind of, ooh, what's my cadence in my marketing strategy to be like, let me hit you every 3 months about your car. But if I'm selling you, say, Lyft, if I'm trying to sell you rides, you're hitting them with incentives on that Thursday or that Friday right before the weekend comes. So I think it does have to do with the type of product you're selling, but you know, I'll let others speak on how they refine their RFM.
There's also the not just frequency versus AOV, but also timing of the emails. I think you can really refine the post-purchase automation based on, so if it's like a replenishable product, it's usually pretty easy to determine when someone's about to run out, and then send emails based on that. So you can both keep frequency low, but focus on AOV. And then if it's a not replenishable product, just looking at historical data to figure out when people have historically repurchased. So you can not bother them when they're not ready to repurchase, and then wait until they're prime.
I think it depends too on your profit margin, your cost of shipping. When I worked at Casper, if we could get them to buy one mattress, we're in pretty good shape, right? And we're willing to cover the shipping cost and the AOV is looking good. Versus at Trade, you know, if we sold a bag of coffee for $15 and we're paying, you know, who knows, $5 or so for shipping and not charging the customer for it, that hurts a little bit more than if we can get them to opt into two bags or, you know, add on in some way. However, if that's a customer who's going to come back and buy coffee once a week or once every other week, we can probably tolerate that versus someone who's one and done and it's really just costing us money to send them that one bag.
One interesting thing I found, and this is at Open Door, which is a online real estate type of buying and selling company. I don't know if anyone's familiar, just because we're not in the major markets, is the life cycle of a home purchase is 7 years. So when you talk about post-purchase automation, we're not going to hit you with, oh, love that home. Well, I got a great one for you now. It just doesn't happen, right? We really need to kind of think, how do we ensure that the experience they just had was good, hit in with an NPS score feedback, and then do kind of good, you know, slow nurture follow-ups. But you're really just trying to stay top of mind for either that next purchase 7 years later or a referral, or how does it, you know, word of mouth get spread from that? Because you really don't look for a second post-purchase after a home. So.
Yeah, that's great. Probably really similar to Jenna's model as well, right? Where you get a mattress. What is that? Is that roughly every 7 years?
Yeah, every like 7 to 10 years. So that's pretty similar. The way I think about it in that kind of business too, I think you were saying it really well, Joey, is like you're trying, I describe my job as trying to extract as much value as possible from our members. So as you know, if I'm being crass about it, it's I want to get them to spend as much as possible, stay as long as possible, refer as many friends as possible, right? So once they're a member, I'm not going to try to get them to, you know, get another membership, but I could get them to buy personal training. I could get them to invite their friends. You know, there's other ways that we can drive value.
Makes sense. I've generally veered on the side of frequency, of focusing on frequency of purchases over AOV. And I actually feel like AOV is one of the worst metrics to gauge success on. Just because someone isn't buying the most expensive product doesn't mean they're not the best customer, or you didn't just basically create a very successful experience for them and they're not going to keep coming back more and more. Joey and I used to actually work at different times, worked at a company called Snapfish, which really took a lot of market share by focusing on the lower price products versus our biggest competitor at the time, which was Shutterfly. And I remember when I was there, everyone kept on complaining about low AOV, and it was irritating because the lower AOV products, we were selling 10x more of them versus, you know, the more expensive products. And the revenue looked great, that the margins were great, but everyone was still complaining that we were selling, you know, $10, $20, $30 products instead of $60, $70, $80 products. And I thought that it was a terrible trade-off to try to push all of our strategy toward the more expensive products when the cheaper products were doing very well. Can you jump to the next one? Has COVID basically affected any of your campaigns? I'd imagine Jenna maybe the most out of anybody, but yeah, I'm curious how it's affected anything that you're leading currently.
Yeah, super casual. You know, we had 105 locations closed for a number of months. Yeah, it was hard. I mean, we went from having hundreds of thousands of people coming in to having all of our clubs closed. So definitely a shock. We really had to pivot quickly to digital engagement. So, you know, when our clubs are closed, we're not going to charge our members. That's not our style. We try to be member-centric, and we're not going to charge them for a service they can't get. So we tried to figure out, again, how can we continue to extract value from these members and keep them engaged while we're closed so that they're still feeling great about Equinox once we come back. So very quickly launched virtual personal training, virtual one-on-one Pilates, and behind the scenes for years now, Equinox and SoulCycle and a couple other of our brands have been working on an app called Baris. So it's a digital app for virtual workouts. If you go on their Instagram account, actually, and go on their IGTV, they've posted a bunch of them there for free. But right now, the app is only available to Equinox members and SoulCycle. I don't know how SoulCycle is choosing exactly who gets it, but there's an at-home Soul Bike, so those members also get access to it. But we're trying to keep them engaged through these digital offerings, and then just being as transparent and human as possible in terms of what we're doing to reopen, what we're doing in terms of safety. We've made a ton of changes in our club experience. We call it the Equinox standard, but you know, there's a temperature check. There's a health declaration you need to fill out before every single visit. You need to book every visit. So we're just trying to really deliver really good, clean, safe experience when you're coming back and be really transparent about it and keep you happy when, you know, your region's still closed.
Makes sense. Joey, how has real estate changed during COVID?
I think that the best play was us recognizing that we should shut down and making a safety statement there. It was for the safety of employees and people. One of the things that we feature is your ability to go into the homes without a realtor, without anybody. You get the app and you use the code, so you walk in. And in itself, that seems like a safe play, but there's still this feeling of, is something lingering in the air? Are the doorknobs dirty? So we said, for the safety of everyone, we shut down. And then as we started to roll back, we still harp on the safety play because it is our priority here. And people have responded. I mean, we're not sure if it's just the company because real estate is bouncing back with full force. But, you know, in these times, you don't want to sound too aggressive or just, you know, try to take advantage of the situation. We just have to say, we took a step back. Everything's safe and clean. It's for our employees. When we're back, we'll let you know. And actually, what's been good is we shut everything down. And by turning everything off, very specific channels, I'm able to look at my automations and clean them up and kind of start from scratch. So now I have a new baseline. Now we have new channels, and now nothing's tainted from old measurement, which has been interesting.
That's great. And I think very much both of your examples, and even I think everyone's examples, even on some of the previous questions, we're not just only focused on how to drive the most revenue per user and how to drive the most kind of like transactional action from all of your users. It's like, let's take care of people. Let's make them feel safe. And I feel like there's a lot of teams I've worked with both on a consulting and in-house basis where like that conversation was never able to be had just because retention is such a high ROI kind of effort. Everyone's just like, just get as much dollars out of them as possible. So it's great that both of you are working in organizations as well that allow you to actually care a little bit more instead of just like, how do we extract every single penny out of our users and you know, keep people excited for the long term.
I used to use the metaphor at some other companies where you're like, you know, to my manager, like, you're asking me to squeeze the water out of the rock right now. Like, I don't know how much I can get more out of this guy. You're like, no, just drop him another email. And it's really sad because most lifecycle marketing or most, you know, channel marketers realize that you can email people more than you think. They're like, they'll take it. Most active members, they'll take it and they respond, which is, it's a volume play and it's kind of sad, but yeah, keep emailing them, keep SMSing and they'll respond. So
there's never a point of drop off, which is, I don't know if anyone saw the case study from that Blue State Digital put out years ago. They ran all the email marketing campaigns for Obama's campaign, his first campaign, I believe. And they tried to see a test. They created all these different segments amongst Obama's database. And they were like, all right, we're going to have some of these segments get emailed an insane amount of times just to see like, when do we finally get to too much? And the scary answer was there is no too much. Every single segment, the more emails they got, the more donation money they got out of them. So yeah, you can absolutely just keep bombarding and spamming people as much as possible and you will get more revenue. But I don't know. I don't have a great answer there. Like it doesn't feel good. I've definitely been in organizations where the answer was always just send 3x more emails, we'll get more money. I'm like, you're not wrong. I don't have a great rebuttal there. So I don't know if anyone has a good rebuttal.
It's interesting because that was sort of the argument that Parsley took at the beginning of COVID and quarantine, because yes, we're in healthcare. We had really luckily launched telemedicine in January because we were previously just in centers in New York, LA, and San Francisco, but we're also a subscription. So do people really want it? Like when everything's up near, do you want to commit to an annual membership? So we were like doing well in terms of what we were selling, but there was some hesitation that other telemedicine companies wouldn't have. And in order to just continue to grow, there was a push to just like, we did a friends and family sale. We really crushed it, had some of our actually like strongest membership weeks, but it did come at a cost because in terms of email, like our product needs a lot of nurturing. There's a lot of education. And by focusing our communications on a promo and just focusing on conversion, we ended up
like not nurturing those new leads, and a lot of them unsubscribe. So we use our old calculation for like how much we could pay for a lead, how much we could pay for a click. And then it ended up not proving out because all of our bandwidth as a team went towards volume and towards conversion. And it actually, it did have a downside, both in terms of like lead value, but then also our bandwidth went towards things that weren't repeatable, weren't scalable. So as soon as we finished an email, we had to create a new one. So now we've started to really pull back on some of that more reactive promo strategy and work much more on our lead nurturing and knowing, like basically updating a lot of our lead nurture flows at the top and mid funnel.
That's an awesome example. And I guess one downside I have seen was you're going to generate a higher conversion rate the bigger the discounts you go out with. But then at some point, your customers will never purchase without a discount.
Right.
So I've seen like, okay, let's go a week without a discount, guys. Let's just try this out. And us getting like emails into customer or companies that I was consulting or working with, getting emails into customer service, be like, hey, you know that discount from 2 weeks ago? Can I just get that? So like, you know, everyone just constantly is unwilling to buy without a discount. So I guess there's other downsides. Let's jump to the next one, Grace. Oh, this is a good one. And I feel like this is an area that a lot of people don't focus on because they often think of like people who have not purchased for a very long time to be, you know, quote unquote dead. So I'm curious if anyone's found some interesting win back strategies.
As part of our really big push at the beginning of COVID, we don't really send promos to churn members, and our policy is like, you can't get that starting discount more than once. But what we did was actually send campaigns to churn members and just really focused on the changes of our membership, like what are like really that what were pain points historically that we've solved, what are new things that we've added, new features, and really talking about the value that exists now that didn't exist necessarily when they churned.
Yeah, I think using Lyft as an example and to what Katie mentioned earlier was looking at your CAC and looking at your LTV of the, so looking at how much it costs to bring that customer in the first place, and then looking at the LTV of that person, you kind of start to segment how many people or which type of people you really want to win back, right? Because what you're probably going to do in a retail environment or in a, you know, ride sharing environment is a heavy incentive. Again, it won't be as great as the first incentive that you got for sign up, but it's going to be pretty large in terms of, you know, if you look at the cadence and they were going every weekend, and then you see that they've dropped off for 2 or 3 months, were they a product switcher? Were they a company switcher or some other thing? How do you bring them back? So obviously you can dump an incentive on them, but without the thought of how much does that person's LTV worth is worth against that incentive for the long term or for at least the next 3 or 6 months, you know, it's just financially not a smart thing to do. So the calculation for that incentive and how aggressive you go, similar to other retail. And you should remind me of Snapfish. Snapfish was like a race to the bottom in terms of how much you can discount, but shockingly the competitors would follow or we would follow them. So sometimes you're just at a loss for that red season. And then you focus on Black Friday or whatever is going to get you back. You just have to make sure that they are going to come back based on, again, going back to RFM.
Yeah, for sure. And like, it's a trade-off of like, how good do you feel about it versus how it shows up in the revenue, right? Because yeah, we definitely took a lot of market share by just price gouging everyone else to the point where they needed to step up and start lowering their prices quite a bit as well. And I can't look back on it and say it was a terrible strategy. It's just no one felt good about it. No one was like, yeah, we win by sending three times as many emails at 50% of the price of our competitors. No one's like, oh yeah, that's exciting. Cool. Any other interesting win-back strategies?
For Vivino, oftentimes the case was good merchandise would beat out good couponing. If you're selling an average wine and you discounted it 20% to win back a customer, that wasn't quite as effective as selling a really rare wine at list price. You know, having good merchandise would always beat out couponing at Vivino. We also tried some experimenting, like combining the two. What do you have? Couponing on top of good merchandise. And it's a little bit more helpful, but like to me, the big lever was good merchandise.
That's cool. And it's great that you have that moat, right? I think not every company is, in an advantageous space to be able to have access to like rare wines and be able to sell that. So that's pretty cool.
For sure. You need a deep catalog for that to work, I think.
Is there ever a point where picking up the phone, and this is actually to the very first question of like, what's an interesting retention tactic? And it might even work here, you know, and obviously it's the most unscalable thing on earth. So, you know, take it for what you will, but at what point does it make sense to just pick up the phone and start calling your customers?
Similar to what I was going to say, Anish, we just started actually scaling SMS a bit, but it looks like it comes from a human. And then when you reply, it does go to a specific human. So we have like a couple of our best salespeople that we're having these SMSs reply to. So we have our members who've canceled between, you know, since COVID, basically, who've canceled their membership. We're sending them a pretty open-ended text message inviting them to come back on Freeze. If they're on Freeze, they'll get access to that app Varis that I mentioned. So they'll get complimentary access to that while they're on Freeze. And then it really just opens up a dialogue to tell them about everything we've done since COVID in terms of health and safety. And it's been really successful. And I know that team sometimes when they're texting with someone, they will just pick up the phone and call them. And, you know, it takes a while, but we kind of just looked last week at how many of these cancels do we actually have? And okay, how many team members is it going to take to scale this? And how long is it going to take to get it out? So it's been a little tedious because we haven't automated it or anything, but we basically have five of our best salespeople working on this. And every day, you know, we're churning through as many SMS as we can get through and basically giving a list that will push out until we get through it. And it's only going to be another week. So like, it's a little painful, but it's worth it because we're seeing such a high save rate compared to emails, which is really the only other free channel that we have to reach them through.
I love that. I've actually never heard that strategy kind of done well before and scaled. And that's really great because you're not calling every person. You're calling the ones who've kind of opted in to reply.
Exactly.
By rallying to.
And we started with high value and we started with, you know, the ones that we really want back. And then it was working so well that we're like, all right, let's churn through this whole list as quickly as we can.
So obviously people were frozen starting like mid-March.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys, do people have to like opt in to become unfrozen, or are you just unfreezing everyone's membership when their geo becomes safe to open gyms?
Yeah. So when their club opens, we basically, or a week before they open. So I think I can say this now, but NYC is opening September 2nd. That email is going out probably between like now and 4 p.m. It's being throttled out. We've been working on it for a while. And basically, so it's a week out, they get an email letting them know their club's opening, telling them about, you know, any of the operational requirements, restrictions, changes. We try to keep it as succinct as possible. And in that email, we give them the option to say, you can come to the club for the first week. We're not going to charge you. You know, you have a week basically to decide what you want to do. And then in that email, we have a link where they could choose to extend their freeze for another 30 days at no cost. So we're, you know, a lot of people are just choosing to freeze when they get that email because they're just personally still not ready to come back or maybe have health concerns, you know, whatever the reason is. But then there are some people who, you know, might be thinking about freezing and then they can come in and try it and decide that they're comfortable. But yeah, we're auto unfreezing them unless they fill out that form.
That's really cool. Anybody else use phone and SMS for any interesting win back?
So I think, going back to what I mentioned earlier in terms of signal tracking and kind of using signal tracking for engagement score, I think if you have the ability to come into a team and build an engagement score, that enables segmentation much easier and you can pick and choose what engagements. And some of the engagements, as Katie mentioned earlier, was like, you know, telemedicine, right? At One Medical, we looked at people who made dialogue via phone. So we're like, all right, we have these people have been familiar with us on the phone. So we take that model and say, all right, target the people whose subscriptions are ending, who have been on the phone with us. How adept are they to receiving a call from us regarding their subscription? And I think if you have that signal in place, a call or a dialogue that occurred, it's way easier for you to say, these people are actually going to pick up their phone and answer this call, or at least be responsive. I always feel like once you get that lead score in place, basically segmentation is just much easier. And it helps in resourcing, right? If you only got five people to call, you say, all right, how many can you crank out a day? This is the segment of high usage telemedicine people. Go for them. And then you can just go down that list as much as resources allow.
Cool. That makes a lot of sense. Great. Jump in the next one. What's your mix of remarketing versus new customer acquisition?
I'm only relating this to, sorry, there's some Dean in the chat who mentions cross-channel comms and win-back. So as a life cycle, I do life cycle marketing at Open Door. The budget is zero, right? It's only the tools. So when we're talking about remarketing, things like direct mail, Dean's question is, how do you guys use cross-channel comms and win-back? Have you seen success in direct mail against lapse high frequency? So to put it in my position, hey, I'm the guy that is using email, using SMS, using all the free channels. And then we're saying, should we try direct mail as something? And there's obviously a cost involved. I will say, full disclosure, we are testing that literally next month. We're coming back and we're going to test this. I think the key is the volume play, right? Can you get the volume, the per piece volume down where it actually outweighs the, or it doesn't, it gets outweighed by the AOV or whatever you call that, your cart. But historically, I haven't seen a lot of post-acquisition direct mail usage, except for seasonal retail like Snapfish or Shutterfly. We went heavy on direct mail to our existing customer base during the holiday season. And then for win back, we just changed the dynamic content for higher incentive. So you have two different pieces of creative, higher incentive for that other, for that win back audience for the segment that had a high AOV in the past, right? So it's a matter of segmentation and just that calculation. But I can say from experience, direct mail is kind of a hard sell in the lifecycle world because from top down, you're looked at as these guys are the cheapest channel and they do it with email and SMS. So it's been difficult selling a direct mail campaign into that.
Yeah, I think, and then to piggyback on what Joey mentioned, I think a lot of what Joey's answer was is like, it depends. And one thing about email though, is like for deliverability's sake, if you haven't, you know, heard from a customer or they haven't opened or clicked an email for, let's say, 12 months or so, you really should not be emailing them ever again because you will run into deliverability issues. And I think the fact that deliverability gets harder and harder every year is actually a good thing. I think people have just abused the email channel way too much and it should be a little bit harder to get in the inbox. But for those users who you think could potentially be good users, but they haven't clicked or opened an email in 12 months, you know, I think direct mail can really be the best channel out there for you to get directly to them. And then also if your audience is a little bit older and they're just not as in tune digitally, I don't have any perfect ratios, but they're more likely to check their normal mail than their email. And so products targeting older audiences can maybe do better with direct mail.
I'd be curious to hear from Jenna. Jenna, I think you were at Casper, right? You guys seem to hit direct mail pretty hard. Is that integrated with your lifecycle team, or is that more just a customer acquisition strategy?
That's all new customer acquisition. The way we thought about it at Casper, and frankly, the way I still think about it, I think logically, if you have an existing customer, I think about, you know, what's the cheapest common denominator, the cheapest way to reach them, and then like stack your way up. So starting with email, if you can't reach them there, SMS, maybe customer service phone, maybe like digital retargeting comes next, then direct mail. Obviously, those could kind of shift, but most of our paid spend was on acquisition.
Makes sense. Where does the line stop between retention and product? Does your work kind of hit conversion rate optimization broken down by specific segments? You know, maybe you guys are having like really custom landing pages for each unique segment, or are there any other strategies beyond that?
Yeah, at Parsley, it's interesting because my background is retention, but we actually don't do a ton on like the marketing growth CRM side of things for retention. We really let the product speak for itself. And I think it depends on what type of company you're selling. But like for us, we work really closely with both our digital product and then our clinical product, because we believe that that's what's going to drive retention more so than anything else. Same thing when I was with Harry's as well. Like we have to work super closely with product because that's the best way to get people to come back. If they didn't like your product, it doesn't matter how great your emails are, how great your push notifications are. So I've always seen that you have to work super closely with both digital product and another type of product if your product isn't only digital.
I couldn't agree more. Being in retention for a company, I feel like my job, I can't take a job unless I believe in the product and unless our customer experience is good, because otherwise they're not coming back. Like my job is impossible if it's a bad product or a bad experience. But at Equinox, I would say our product and marketing team, there's a couple of our product people on the line actually, we're separate teams, but we work so closely together. There's a lot of projects that we work on where we're basically operating as one team. The app in particular is so core to the member experience at Equinox. And there's parts of the app that marketing can control directly. You know, our product team has empowered us with push notifications, with certain in-app features that we can kind of control and segment in really specific, personalized ways. And the parts that we can, we just work really closely together to make sure it's the best experience and make sure it's delivering on what our, you know, company and team goals are.
Yeah, I want to answer something in a very tactical level. It talks about, I mean, the question is, where does the line stop between retention and product? And at the most tactical level, when you're sending out emails or sending out SMS, not working with the product team to get that CTA to the absolute right place, like, you have to work with them simply just to get that deep link. And 9 times out of 10, it's not going to work correctly the first time. So the product experience has to be in line with the call to actions in all your retention comms. And then even further to that, product usually controls the transactional emails. So if product has the transactional emails, you're doing the marketing emails. If those aren't in sync, each customer is getting 2 different campaigns, really. You know, they're getting all these like flashy, lots of image-based marketing campaigns, and then they're getting these letter format, all text transactional emails, and they don't really see that they're the same company. So with product, you have to kind of get in there and say, hey, let's look at this. Let me give you a template, or let me at least give you some guidelines. So we are looking in step. Without that, and without, I mean, at the tactical level, just the right deep links, it doesn't really serve. If all your call to actions are just driving back to blahblahblah.com instead of blahblahblah.com/user/login page/whatever, product is failing you in your retention tactics.
That's great. That's actually a really good point from the tracking end.
I'm a control freak, so I like picking software where I need the product team as little as possible. With transactional emails, of course, you really need products and coordination there. But one thing I think in some senses, your CRM lifecycle team can analyze and look at data in ways that are creative or perhaps ways that your product team isn't thinking about. And sometimes you can find some really nice insights and bring those to the product team based on what you're seeing. Just because as a lifecycle team, you're thinking about segments and slicing up your database constantly. And sometimes there's really good product ideas that come out of that.
Makes a lot of sense. We can jump to the next one, Grace.
Interesting.
What criteria have been the most successful in predicting churn? It's a really good question.
For me, it's check-ins. It's if they're not coming into Equinox at least, you know, a certain number of times per month, we know very quickly who's going to churn. Even, you know, if we look at a member's first 60 days, by the end of that, we have a pretty good idea of who's at risk and who we should really start to go after to try to get them into the club.
Yeah. And for us, it's definitely like engagement with the product, but not only engagement, but speed to first engagement. So as part of our work in COVID to really focus on them, like retaining members, basically, we worked on an onboarding flow that was, yes, to tell you more about your membership and what to expect, but really with the goal of pushing you into your first doctor's visit, because once you've experienced it, you're much more likely to see the value and not churn. But the people who would churn hadn't scheduled their visits. So really trying to get people in those visits.
Yeah, I think Facebook had a metric that I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like if you didn't add 10 friends by your 7th day after registration, your likelihood to churn was significantly higher. So they focused a lot of their initial onboarding emails on like, hey, add your friends. Hey, add your friends. Here's a bunch of sample friends. At Snapfish, we had something similar to that. I can't remember the exact numbers either, but if you hadn't uploaded X amount of photos to your database by X amount of days after registration, I don't know, we'll call it uploaded 5 photos by 14 days after registration, your likelihood to churn was significantly higher. So a lot of our messages were focused on upload your first photo, upload your first photo, upload your first photo, instead of like, hey, buy a photo book where you're supposed to already have, you know, 45 or so pictures uploaded, like first things first.
At Vivino, they extract data from both, or extract value rather, from both their subscriber list and their application, their mobile app. And for a lot of years, we made the mistake of just thinking about the mobile app. And it took us a while to figure out that there was a large portion of email subscribers that weren't really using the app, but they were still making purchases from Luvino, and just like separating those two and realizing that we should be taking a look at different measurements for churn for both the app and in that silo, and then the churn metrics for just email subscription lists. That was really helpful. Of course, there's a portion of users that fall into both genders, but just realizing, you know, not everybody fits into this bucket of like your core product, and you might be able to extract value from people outside of that, and be sure to check out your churn metrics from that as well.
That's really great. So what was the difference between app and kind of non-app users? Which ones were more loyal? Which ones churned more?
It's really about 50-50. There's a lot of wine buyers that like sign up to these lists just to get access to great merchandise, as we talked about earlier. So, you know, they might have downloaded the Vivino app to give Vivino their email address, but they're not really interested in using the Vivino app from that point they're on. And they just find themselves where they love the emails and they love the merchandise that they're getting in the months. And for the longest time, Vivino was ignoring that segment. And then it realized, well, we got a pocket of users here that we can extract a lot of value from. Let's keep emailing them. Let's keep them engaged. So from an email side, you know, the churn metric is, you know, last open date, last click date, things of that nature. And then on the app side, it's how often are you using it as a utility? How often are you scanning wines, rating wines, things of that nature? And it truly is. It's about 50-50 value app to email list.
Well, that's a boring answer, Brian. I thought I was going to learn something there. Like one like way better.
I would say, I think the surprising thing is probably the email list, though. I mean, there's a lot of value there that I think when you look at Luvino from an outside perspective, you just think it is a wine app, but it just makes a lot of money just doing classic email stuff, classic retention stuff. But there's a lot of value there for sure. It's surprising.
Yeah. I've done work with Brand at Luvino. And one of the interesting things is that your retention teams are significantly larger than your acquisition teams. I think like your retention teams are like what? Somewhere from like 5 to 7 people, and your acquisition team is like one person, which is pretty much the exact opposite of almost every other like e-com or direct-to-consumer company. So that's really amazing that you guys focus so much on retention.
Yeah, it's true. The thing is about the app though is they probably get about 10,000 downloads per day organically without a customer acquisition team. So, but if you think about all the fixed costs involved around that, around engineering, product teams, you know, they truly built a like incredible product there. And there's a lot of investment behind that. Over time, you know, you need to do less and less R&D and invest into that. So, you know, you start becoming more and more efficient. But in some senses, their customer acquisition is really expensive. It's just not in the traditional sense of going out and doing display ads on your Facebooks and Googles.
Makes a lot of sense.
One thing I did see in predicting churn is but a lot of the models that we've used, you know, propensity to return or propensity to convert again, has been based off what I mentioned, the RFM, just looking at the latency since the last ride or the last engagement with the health provider. What I found is actually with higher engagement products or higher involved, make it about the customer and start to do surveys, kind of do a progressive profile about like, hey, how are you doing now? Are you looking to buy a home? Are you considering this? Have you looked at the refi market? It enables you to do two things. One is, you know, you keep them engaged. Two, they start to talk about themselves versus us trying to push a product. But then three, you also get a profile on, oh, look, they're not considering a home anymore. Now they're starting to go to refi. All right, bring the mortgage service in. So no one likes surveys, but when you start to get kind of profiles and you start to ask them more about themselves, I think it also, it definitely helps predict churn because it keeps them engaged. And also, you know, they could literally say, you know what, not interested right now, don't call me. You save yourself from a spam trap right there, or you at least an unsubscribe. So that's good. But sometimes mixing it up with your nurture flows, not just always pushing product and kind of asking back, forms that dialogue, and it really does help predict churn.
That's great.
I'd be curious about with Lyft, if you guys had any like ways to predict churn and also like false positives, right? Because just because someone doesn't take a ride for 4 months doesn't mean they're going to stop using Lyft, right? They might just be on vacation somewhere I don't know, in stuck in COVID at home or whatever else. Were there any learnings within that?
I think it's open, so it's fine to say that the dirtiest tactic was both us and Uber were always looking to say, let us know when they're using the Uber app or have they downloaded. So we're always looking who's downloaded the other product. You know, there's a lot of companies who are selling like, oh, they've downloaded that product or they're using that product. So, and only because ride sharing is such an easy switch product. So looking at, you know, switching costs or switching ability really helped us understand, are they really churned or are they just kind of using the other person because they got their first 50 rides free again and that happened. So
interesting. Yeah, I can imagine. So then what do you do when someone has, you know, that they're using both Uber or Lyft and whatever other second or third tier kind of ride share service as well? I feel like little pockets of the US have their local one. What was the strategy that was different from when you knew someone else had Uber versus when they didn't?
Well, we definitely stayed away from kind of getting into the race to the bottom discounting war, right? You just know if it's a new sign up for the other person, then they're like, okay, they're probably writing out their first $50 in free ride credit. And then you kind of say, all right, now it's time for us to come back in. But it's just a matter of segmentation and saying, all right, this is a group that looks like they're high switchers all the time. And you got to get historicals, right? Again, back to the RFM. Oh, they're frequent, but they also take these pockets of breaks. So that's one group. And then there's just the other guy who's all the time using the product and then stops. And that's kind of where you want to employ your win-back tactics, whatever they may be at the time. If it's high incentive, then it's a high incentive. If it's, it was really an incentive play in ride sharing.
Okay. That's fascinating. Yeah. I'd be curious about Harry's as well. Like with razors, right? Like was the goal to get someone to only use Harry's razors or how did you factor in someone was just trying your razors and then, you know, trying another one and might come back?
Yeah. So it's interesting because like we had both subscription and like one-off purchasing, but what we were giving away is like the carrot was a free trial of the handle. And so the handle didn't work with other blades. So it was kind of like, we knew there would be some amount, like first to second order didn't always match frequency and didn't match kind of the purchase time you would expect given the frequency because they had another razor handle and blade that they wanted to finish out what they had previously. And then there were some people who liked it enough and didn't matter. They had extra of something else but they were about to go use Harry's kind of exclusively, but we didn't see that many people going back and forth after that first to second order because the system was a system separate from something else. So we kind of like left space between the first and second order kind of stuff, or first and second order email flows. But after that, it would be pretty predictable because you could assume they had pretty much switched.
Okay. Amazing. So we are coming up on time here. Thanks you guys for giving so much insight about how you guys ran retention for multiple popular companies. And thanks to the entire audience. Interestingly enough, I think about 48 people were there at the beginning and we still have 48 people in there right now. So hopefully that's a good sign.
Retention.
Right? Nice. Pun intended. Cool. Well, again, thanks a lot, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.